Hello and welcome to the Food Engineering Podcast. I'm Michael Costa, Editor-in-Chief of Food Engineering Magazine, and today our guest is Earl Arnold, Global Manager, Food Defense and the Food Safety Modernization Act at AIB International. Welcome to the podcast, Earl.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Today, we'll discuss the latest in food defense regulations for U.S. processors using imported ingredients and what they need to know to be compliant. And this also ties into a feature story about food defense that we have in our October magazine, so be sure to check that out. And Earl, before we get started, for those who aren't familiar, can you give our listeners some background on what food defense is and why it's needed for U.S. food processors?
Yes, absolutely. So food defense has been around in the food industry for a significant amount of years. However, it kind of slowly changed after the events that happened in the United States September 11th, where obviously everybody knows about the terrorist attack. Shortly thereafter, President Bush asked his security directives to include FDA and USDA to start doing some research on the potential threats that could affect the nation's food supply chain. And from there is where we really kick off with regulatory requirements for food defense. The first regulation that came out was the Bioterrorism Act of 2002. And this regulation was really a reactionary type regulation where it just required food facilities that were associated with the FDA, that was required to register, was under FDA's purview, to register at one time with FDA. And what FDA would do is if they ever got any type of information of a threat of an ingredient or a food facility or anything like that, then they would have reached out to those facilities. It also required anybody that was importing product into the United States to notify FDA or Border Protection Agency of that commodity coming in. And this way it allowed FDA to determine based on information whether they needed to look at an ingredient or a product in a little bit more detail. And then after that, in 2011, when the Food Safety Modernization Act was written, it had a lot more information on what FDA was looking for and the United States was looking for when it comes to food defense, which is really preventing acts of intentional adulteration where there would be an intent to cause wide-scale public health harm. And this is really the focus of where the industry is now in the United States, as well as any facilities that create ingredients or products that they're going to import into the United States for consumption here.
Okay. And I think that's an important point to make is that food defense is guarding against the intentional adulteration of ingredients. And I think somebody looking at it more broadly might think that food fraud falls under that umbrella, but it doesn't, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Now, from FDA's original thinking, when they first began working on the regulation 21 CFR 121, mitigation strategies to protect food from acts of intentional adulteration, they initially in the proposed regulation had what FDA calls EMA or economically motivated adulteration in it. However, when they got a lot of responses and comments from the industry during that proposal timeframe, FDA relooked at it and agreed with most of the comments, which were saying, even though food fraud is intentional, the methods or the reasons behind it are a lot different. For fraud, it's, I'm just trying to make extra money. So I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to kill anybody. In fact, I don't even want you to know that I'm doing this thing. So I'm trying to be sneaky so you can't catch it so I can still make a profit. On the other hand, intentional adulteration really is, I have an intent to hurt or damage or kill. And so there's a different methodology. And so that's why FDA removed food fraud and kind of moved it over towards the food safety part.
Oh, okay. Okay. And what are the major areas that a food processor in the US needs to cover to be compliant with food defense regulations?
So this is a major, major significant change. As I mentioned, a lot of food facilities all over the world have had some sort of food defense program in place. Prior to the Food Safety Modernization Act, most of these programs were also reactionary in nature and security focused. And what I mean by that is a lot of individuals looked at their security measures they had on the exterior of their facility, such as fencing, lighting, alarms, cameras, those kinds of things, so they could prevent somebody bad from coming into the facility to do something wrong. And that's where the program was mainly geared towards for a lot of facilities. When FSMA came out, they said, yes, these things are important, and you may even be able to leverage some of these types of activities in what we're asking you to do. However, the Food Defense Regulation basically asks facilities to look at all of the products that they produce and all of the ingredients and raw materials that they receive, and also look at each of the processing steps that they do to make those products, and evaluate each processing step for the potential of someone being able to do something bad. And FDA really wants that focus to be around the potential of an insider. Before they wrote the regulation, they reached out to security experts and got their interpretation of who they thought may be the most dangerous kind of person to consider for something like this new program. And everyone pointed their finger to the potential insider. The risk is greater that way.
And is it more difficult for a processor today to be compliant with the U.S. Food Defense Program? And if so, why? And I guess today, meaning, you already set the benchmark of September 11th. But since September 11th, has it become more difficult?
So it became more difficult. Now, FDA, once the Food Safety Modernization Act came out, and specifically Section 106 within it, is where Congress and the President had said, this is what we want you to consider. So FDA took those requirements in 106 and created the regulation, but the regulation didn't come out until May of 2016. The regulation then became actually effective 60 days later, but it was tiered, meaning that business size determined when a facility had to be fully compliant. Now, here we are sitting in September of 2021, and all of the compliance dates for all types of facilities have been met. In other words, we've reached them. The last one was July of this year of 2021. So it's really only been since 2016 that they've had to really focus on what these requirements are. It's a lot more intensive in where we're looking for. And to give you a little bit more specifics, what FDA asks when a facility is looking at a processing step, in some way in spirit, they also, when they're doing their vulnerability assessment, need to look at three elements, is what FDA calls them. The first one is, how accessible is food product at that processing step? So in other words, could an insider reach out and touch it? The second one is the ability of someone to do something bad. So considerations like, is this processing step in an isolated area, or is this processing step in a heavily visual area? And then the third one is, what would be the public health impact if someone did actually add some type of contaminant at this processing step? And so when they evaluate those three elements, they determine then if they have what's called an actionable process step, which is a processing step where, due to the significant vulnerability, facilities need to implement controls or mitigation strategies. And this is a little bit more unique than what we were doing before for food defense. And so that's the challenge.
And what are some of the most common areas that can be overlooked by a food processor when it comes to complying with food defense regulations?
So that's actually a really interesting question. And for my perspective, FDA has published draft guidance for this regulation, and it's understood that it's only draft guidance now. But one of the new terms that they brought out in it was called inherent characteristics. And what FDA was saying about inherent characteristics is when you're looking at a processing step, if you're looking at something that's inherent to the process, then you can consider it, and it may already have reduced your risk at that processing step. And examples that they give in the draft guidance about inherent characteristic is something that's already present that has to be present in order for that processing step to work. And a good example of this could be, let's say that you're at a processing step that always requires more than two people to get that job done. And if one person was only there, that processing step wouldn't work. So that's a good example of an inherent characteristic. So if I'm reviewing a processing step and I have that, I'm obviously going to have a lower risk type processing step. However, if I have things in place, like say a lock on a tank, because I want to make sure somebody doesn't get access to it, or access control to a certain room because I feel it's a sensitive area, FDA does not consider that inherent. It's called a non-inherent characteristic. So if this is already in place, when I'm reviewing that that processing step, I'm supposed to pretend that that control is not in place. And if I deem that processing step as high risk, I could maybe then leverage that process as a quote mitigation strategy, whereby now I can prove after I've implemented that strategy that it's under control. And what I've seen out there in a lot of people's assessments when I review them is just that. They're automatically considering all controls they've already had in place, and they're missing the intent of what FDA is asking them to look for. And so missing those things is one of the biggest gaps. The second one is FDA in the draft guidance also poses what they call key activity types. And before FDA wrote this regulation, they did vulnerability assessments on 50 plus different types of facilities that volunteered. And when they did those assessments, they identified these four key types of activities as always high risk. It didn't matter the type of products being produced or the equipment that was used. It just always came out as high risk. And they're bulk liquid receiving and loading, secondary ingredient handling, liquid storage, and then mixing and blending activities. Now, within the draft guidance, FDA further explains what goes on these areas and what these areas are truly considered as key activity types. And a lot of people don't really read into what did FDA mean by secondary ingredient handling or liquid storage and handling. And if you read into it, you find that a lot of processing steps that people evaluate actually has some of these activities, but they overlook it because it's not really something they've normally dived that deep into. And so they miss those potential opportunities where there still could be some high risk.
And from an ingredient standpoint, are there any that are under more scrutiny than others by the FDA, or are they all kind of treated the same?
In general, they're all treated the same. However, FDA does look at what those ingredients are primarily used for. So like as an example, if I'm a facility making an ingredient that normally goes into, say, infant formula or some other type of higher threshold group that has, maybe compromised immune systems, then they may look at those ingredients in more detail than others. But outside of that, they're all treated the same.
And we've already touched on some of the milestones with food defense, but are there any others historically that have made a significant difference?
One of the main ones that I've saw is that also a lot of the Global Food Safety Initiative type audit schemes have also included food defense elements in it in the last 5 or so years. So realistically, even if you're not required to comply with FDA in the United States or you're exporting to the US, GFSI has also included food defense requirements as well. Now, although not as specifically as strict as what FDA is asking for, but pretty significant, and almost any food facility either follows the GFSI scheme or is under regulatory requirements. So really you can look at as food defense being an integral part throughout the whole food industry, no matter what.
And would something like blockchain be effective in making food defense more effective? Or is that reliant more on the overseas processors, the overseas companies providing the ingredients to be part of it?
So I realistically think that program can be leveraged to assist in some of these requirements in food defense, absolutely. However, realistically, from the regulatory requirement, it's standalone. FDA doesn't care how facilities implement it or what programs they leverage, as long as they're meeting the intent of the regulatory requirements.
What recent changes have been made to the U.S. food defense program that processors need to know about?
So the first and foremost one should be that, as a side note, USDA and FDA are coming more in alignment. And although USDA has separate types of requirements for food defense, when you start looking at their website and some of the tools that they offer for USDA facilities to leverage and utilize, there's a lot more cross-reference to say, hey, go look at FDA stuff. Like, for instance, if a facility is looking for templates to create vulnerability assessments and food defense plans on USDA's website, it's see FDA's food defense information. So I have a feeling that in the near future, could be 5 years down the road or so, we're going to see more closely knit regulations in the United States, period. Within the food defense element, what everybody should know is how FDA is currently looking at food defense. Some already know this, but others may not. FDA currently is going to be taking about the next 2 years to use what I call the kid's glove approach to inspecting the requirements of food defense. As I mentioned, it was tiered and all of our compliance dates have been reached. The first group, the largest facilities, they were supposed to be compliant July of 2019. So FDA, when they do an inspection, they're doing what's called an FDA quick check, where they're really reviewing the basic requirements. They'll ask, hey, can we take a look at your food defense plan? They're going to review it relatively quickly, looking to make sure you've met those regulatory requirements. And then they're going to ask about anywhere from 10, 15 to 20 questions on your plan or looking for verification, just to make sure that you're hitting those targets. If they see gaps, they're educating you on what those gaps may be. But as of right now, I have not noted any 483 observations from FDA or violations on food defense since they rolled out the program. So they did this very similar format when they rolled out all the Food Safety Modernization Act regulations. They call it educating as they regulate. So it's important to know that they are looking at the regulatory requirements, but right now they're only just looking basics. The main reason for this is because this program is new to them as it is new to the industry. In other words, this is the first time FDA has ever regulated food defense. So they don't have any data or anything. So they're collecting data in this 2 years to help them out, as well as get a better understanding of how facilities are doing things. Now, what should be understood is that when FDA is done with this process, FDA could, when they're going into a facility and showing up at your facility, could say they're there doing just an IA inspection or a GMP inspection or preventative controls inspection. And so later on, after this time frame, when FDA visits, it could be just a deep dive of your food defense program.
And I'm sure there are a few processors out there that think they're regulated enough. But if if you can shed a little light on how important the food defense program is in this country and how has it helped to keep the food supply safe here?
Yeah, there are a lot of examples, although hard to find, about how food defense can impact the business. The biggest news story that we saw in the last couple of years is what happened in Australia. And many of you may remember this is where they were finding needles inside of their strawberries. The impact on the growers was significant. They were dumping ton after ton after ton of strawberries because the consumers were so terrified that they might find needles into their product. I mean, Australia and the growers associations and their government tried everything that they could to get still consumers to buy, like chop it up, don't throw it out. And they were promoting that they were sending all of this stuff through metal detectors and showing how the metal detector would catch a needle if it would be present, but it still impacted significantly. If they would have had similar regulations that we have now when it comes to regulated food defense plans, I think this issue would have been a lot more difficult to occur and or would have been caught before it even got out into the public, if that makes sense. So that's just one of many different times that a food defense issue has happened. In many cases, it's caught before it gets out into consumers, but sometimes it doesn't. Another good example of this I saw a news story not too long ago of a company that makes frozen dough, and they ended up recalling their product from local grocery stores. And the root cause or the main reason for the recall was they stated in the article that glass was intentionally added to their product. So that's another example of a food defense intentional act of trying to harm individuals. So that's the main reason why you have this food defense program in place, to make sure, one, that it doesn't impact a consumer, because nobody wants to see that. Two, it protects your business and your brand, because we all know that if our brand gets damaged, it's really hard or it's a long road to get back from that type of issue. And so realistically, this is going to, this is one of the more important programs that's come out in years.
Okay. And you've answered all my questions. Was there anything you wanted to add or something I missed?
Not that I can think of. Just remember, ladies and gentlemen, that realistically, I love the way that the FDA made this regulation, because what they're doing is relying on you and your company to be experts of the products you make and produce. There is no true prescription of what you have to do if you identify gaps or you feel things need to be mitigated. They don't even tell you the frequencies for which you may need to do these things. They allow you, the expert, to justify how you develop your program and what you're implementing. And so realistically, these programs are still in your hands. When FDA comes to review or inspect, they're just confirming mainly that you're following your plan and that it really does meet regulatory requirements. And as long as you're controlling everything, it's going to be a very easy inspection from that point. And you can bet that you're going to have a significantly more well-defended product that can minimize a lot of issues for your consumers and your brand.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, Earl.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And thanks to you, our listeners. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a guest on the podcast, you can contact me via email at costam@bntmedia.com. Until next time, this is Michael Costa on the Food Engineering Podcast.